Today on Solving JFK, we'll explore what happened in the Dallas jail from the time Oswald arrived from being arrested at the Texas Theater on Friday afternoon until he was shot by Ruby on Sunday morning. We'll look at questions like, why wasn't Oswald given a lawyer? How long was he interrogated? What do the known interrogation notes say? And who did Oswald call while he was in jail?
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
This is Solving JFK. I'm your host, Matt Crumpton.
Has he made any admissions at all about the shooting of the police officer?
No, nothing. He denies everything.
I really don't know what the situation is about. Nobody has told me anything except that I'm accused of murdering a policeman. I know nothing more than that, and I do request for someone to come forward to give me a legal assistance.
Did you kill the president?
No, I've not been charged with that. In fact, nobody has said that to me yet. The first thing I heard about was when the newspaper reporters in the hall asked me that question.
Here comes Oswald down the hall again.
You fire that rifle.
What dispatches you people have been given, but I emphatically deny these charges.
Oswald has hustled through a doorway.
We just heard the first interaction between Oswald and the media on Friday, November 22nd. This took place at the Dallas Police Department after Oswald had arrived from the Texas Theater. Later that evening, around 8 o'clock, as Oswald was being transferred from one room to another, he had this exchange with reporters in the hallway.
I'd like some legal representation. These police officers have not allowed me to have any. I don't know what this is all about.
I killed the president. Black
guy. No, sir, I didn't. People keep asking me that. Sir?
Did you shoot the president?
I work in that building.
Were you in the building at the time?
Naturally, if I work in that building, yes, sir.
Back up, man.
Did you shoot the president?
No, they're taking me in because of the fact that I live in the Soviet Union. I'm just a patsy.
The president?
Although he had requested a lawyer many times, he still had not been given one as of 8 o'clock Friday night. Initially, Oswald requested New York lawyer John Apt, who was known for his defense of political prisoners. If not Apt, Oswald's second choice was someone from the American Civil Liberties Union, or the ACLU. Incidentally, ACLU lawyers did come to the Dallas jail on Friday night to meet with Oswald, but they were told by the Dallas police that Oswald didn't want a lawyer. So the ACLU left without ever speaking to him. Oswald never had a lawyer, and the Dallas police directly prevented him from having one, whether it was intentional or not. But Oswald's lack of legal counsel didn't stop the Dallas police or the FBI from questioning him. From the time he was arrested on Friday at 2 o'clock until Sunday morning around 11 a.m., Oswald was interrogated for 12 hours. During these interrogations, there were no recordings made or notes taken. The only source of information about what happened during those 12 hours are reports that were written after the fact from memory by some of the people who were present during some parts of the interrogations. So the record that we have of Oswald's interrogation is cloudy and imperfect at best. And there are no notes at all regarding the interrogation sessions that began on Friday at 4:20, 6:20, and 7:40. What we know about these sessions from the notes that have been cobbled together is that Oswald reiterated to police the same things that he had said to the reporters on camera, that he was a patsy, that he did not shoot the president or Officer Tippit, and that he had previously been in the Soviet Union. There were 5 Secret Service agents and 4 FBI agents who were present for parts of Oswald's interrogations, but for whatever reasons, none of those agents were ever questioned by the Warren Commission or even asked to submit affidavits about their interrogation of Oswald. Here are some of the highlights of what Oswald said during his interrogation, according to the typed-up notes of Captain Fritz. Oswald said he was having lunch on the first floor at the time the president was shot. He said that he was on the second floor drinking a Coca-Cola when the policeman came in. When Oswald was asked why he left the building, he said that with all the excitement, he didn't think there would be much work left to do for the rest of the day. Oswald said that he did not own a rifle, but he did own a shotgun when he lived in Russia. Oswald admitted that he did own a pistol, which he picked up before he went to the Texas Theater from his rooming house. When asked why he brought the pistol with him, he said, quote, "You know how boys do when they have a gun, they just carry it." He said that he bought the pistol a few months earlier in Fort Worth. He told the police that he had been in Russia for 3 years and that he did write to the Russian embassy. He said that he spoke Russian and he got newspapers from Russia. He also said that he belonged to the Fair Play for Cuba committee. He said that he picked up the name Alex Hiddell while he was working in New Orleans for Fair Play for Cuba. Oswald denied bringing curtain rods or any sort of long package to work on the day of the assassination. He said that the reason he lived in a rooming house away from his wife and children was because his wife needed help with the kids and Mrs. Payne wanted to learn Russian. So it was a nice arrangement for both of them. Oswald refused to take a polygraph test. And finally, Captain Fritz mentions at the end that he had to leave the room frequently to talk with other witnesses and officers as they came in. So there are large blocks of time when Oswald was interrogated that are not captured at all in Fritz's notes. Like anyone in jail, Oswald was allowed to make some phone calls. One of those calls continues to be the subject of much speculation. It has to do with a call that Oswald tried to place to Raleigh, North Carolina. When switchboard operators Alvita Treon and Luis Sweeney were working at the Dallas City Hall after the assassination, the switchboard received a call from Oswald at the jail. There were 2 men in suits who were there that day that demanded to listen to the call. Alvita Treon says that she saw her coworker, Mrs. Sweeney, unplug and disconnect Oswald's call without ever trying to put the call through. Sweeney, however, did write down the numbers that Oswald tried to call. Then Sweeney tore the page off her notepad and threw it in the wastebasket. After Mrs. Sweeney left work that day, Alvita Treon retrieved the slip of paper from the trash so that she would have a keepsake of the historic event. Then, Treon's slip of paper was later provided to Sherman Skolnick during a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit. The slip says, quote, "John Hurt in Raleigh, North Carolina, 419-834-7430 or 833-1253. The first number was for a John David Hurt. The second was for John William Hurt. While there is nothing particularly noteworthy about John William Hurt, Warren Report critics point out that John David Hurt served as a U.S. Army counterintelligence special agent during World War II. House Select Committee on Assassinations lawyer Sorrell Brady, who was in charge of investigating the Raleigh call for the HSCA, said that the fact that Hurt had been in the counterintelligence service was, quote, provocative. Okay, so I've never been a huge weed person, but this guy that I know, let's just say, is. So whether you're like me or the guy I know, or you're really into weed, whatever it is, you're about to nerd out big because there's this company called Mood, Mood.com, that's changing the way people buy cannabis. Here's the science, and this is the part I love. The reason different cannabis strains make you feel different ways isn't just about THC. It's also based on other components called terpenes. Terpenes influence how your bud tastes and smells, but they also affect what you feel. So one terpene might make you feel uplifted and energetic, and another one makes you relaxed and sleepy. There are dozens of these. So when you have the right combination of terpenes, you can feel social, focused, creative, aroused, chilled out, or whatever. You just go to mood.com, click Shop by Mood, and that's it. Want to be more social at a party? There's flower for that. Need to focus and get more work done? There's flower for that. Want to melt into your couch and watch movies? Yep, flower for that too. And here's the part few people realize. It's now 100% federally legal to have really great bud shipped right to your door. It's third-party lab tested and comes in a discreet box. Best of all, everything is backed by Mood's 100-day satisfaction guarantee. And like I said, you can get 20% off with code JFK. So head to mood.com and get 20% off of your first order with code JFK. You're listening to this podcast, so I know you've got a curious mind. Here's a helpful fact that you might not know yet. Drivers who switch and save with Progressive save over $900 on average. Pop over to progressive.com, answer some questions, and you'll get a quick quote with discounts that are easy to come by. In fact, 99% of their auto customers earn at least one discount. So visit progressive.com and see if you can enjoy a little cash back. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $946 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2024 and May 2025. Potential savings will vary. Victor Marchetti is the former special assistant to the deputy director of the CIA who resigned in 1969 in disillusionment. Marchetti then wrote The CIA and the Cult of Intelligence, which was heavily redacted and censored by the CIA before it even came out. Marchetti says that Oswald was following the standard intelligence practice of contacting a cutout, a clean intermediary with no direct involvement in the operation, when he contacted John Hurt. Now, this does sound like a big deal. Oswald uses one of his precious calls while in jail to reach out to some random guy who just happens to have a background in military intelligence. Well, it's actually a little bit cloudier than that. John Hurt was interviewed in 1980 by Grover Proctor Jr., and he denied knowing anything about Oswald trying to call him. By 1963, Hurt was completely disabled, according to the Veterans Administration, and he was out of work. He was also an alcoholic. After John Hurt died in 1981, his wife told researcher Henry Hurt that John had called the Dallas jail to speak to Oswald because he was so upset after President Kennedy was killed. And Hurt then left his phone number with the jail for Oswald to call him back. And that's the reason Oswald tried to call John Hurt. Okay, so it sounds like this Raleigh call to John Hurt is maybe a big nothing burger after all. Hurt's wife says the only reason Oswald even had Hurt's number was because Hurt himself had called Oswald in the jail. But what I don't understand about this explanation from Hurt's wife is that Oswald provided two phone numbers and one name to the operator. But both numbers were for that same name. Why would Oswald provide two phone numbers for two different John Hurts to the operator if John D. Hurt had just called and left only his phone number for Oswald to call back? Why would John D. Hurt know the phone number of John W. Hurt and leave that one, especially since the two men were not related and didn't know one another? So in the end, we must choose between either this hard-to-believe tale about Hurt calling Oswald and leaving another number for another John Hurt in Raleigh along with his own number, or Oswald calling an intelligence cutout who, according to the Veterans Administration, was a completely disabled alcoholic at the time. On the morning of Sunday, November 24th, 1963, Jack Ruby shot and killed Oswald in the basement of the Dallas Police parking garage as Oswald was being transferred to the county jail. But aside from this being the transfer of the accused assassin of the President of the United States, were there any other reasons for police to have been worried about potential assassins making an attempt on Oswald's life? The quick answer is yes. There were three anonymous threats called in overnight in the hours immediately before Oswald was shot. One was to the local FBI office, one to the Dallas County Sheriff's, and the other to the Dallas Police. The calls came from an unidentified man who warned that a committee had decided to, quote, kill the man that killed the president. The Warren Report doesn't tell us much about the threat that was received by the FBI, just that an FBI agent relayed that threat to the Dallas Police. But the warning call to the Sheriff's Department was specific. According to Sheriff's Officer Perry McCoy, quote, at 2:15 a.m., I received a call from a person who stated that he was going to kill Oswald while he was in the process of being transferred to the county jail, and that he wanted the department to have the information so that none of the deputies would get hurt. His voice was deep and coarse. A third call was placed to Dallas Police Dispatcher Billy Grammer on Saturday night. According to Grammer, he got a phone call that night saying, quote, you have to change the plan. If not, we're going to kill him. Grammer personally knew Jack Ruby, and the anonymous caller said Grammer's name when he spoke to him. The next day, after Ruby had killed Oswald, Billy Grammer identified Ruby as the anonymous person who had called in to the Dallas Police Dispatch. Here's Grammer talking about the incident in The Men Who Killed Kennedy.
I thought I recognized the voice, but at the same time, I could not put a face or a name with the voice. And as we talked, he began telling me that we needed to change the plans on moving Oswald from the basement, that he knew of the plans to make the move, and if we did not make a change, the statement he made precisely was, we are going to kill him. No sooner than I turned it on and they were telling that Jack Ruby had killed Oswald, then I suddenly realized, you know, knowing Jack Ruby the way I did, this was the man I was talking to on the phone last night. At that time, I put the voice with the face, and I knew within myself that Jack Ruby is the one that made that call to me the night before. And I think it was obvious because he knew me and I knew him, and he called me by name over the telephone. And seeing this and knowing what I knew and what he had said, then to me it had to be Jack Ruby. He made the statement, we are going to kill him. which leads me to believe that this was not a spontaneous thing that happened on the spur of the moment. He was watching Oswald coming out the door, and all of a sudden he decided to shoot him. I do not believe that. I think this was a planned event, with him being the man to do the shooting.
This seems like a smoking gun that implicates Ruby in a possible conspiracy, especially since the caller used the phrase, "We are going to kill him." But there are a few issues with putting too many eggs into the Billy Grammer basket. First, if Ruby was part of a conspiracy to silence Oswald, why would he call the police to warn them about it? Wouldn't that potentially make his job of killing Oswald on behalf of the conspiracy harder? The idea of this phone call happening doesn't really support Ruby being part of a conspiracy, unless you want to go full-blown conspiracy and say that Ruby wanted to have it in the record that there were other people helping him by leaving this crumb trail. That's an interesting argument, but based on what we know right now, it's too speculative for me to rely on. The other issue with Billy Grammer's story is that there's no copy of Grammer's police report about the person that he said was Jack Ruby calling in on Saturday night. But Grammer is certain that he wrote a report and that this incident happened. Here he is talking to a local TV station a few years ago about it.
Dallas PD had told the public that Oswald was going to be transferred to the county jail by armored vehicle. What the public did not know was that armored vehicle was a decoy. Oswald would be hidden and transferred in another vehicle.
This guy that called knew about that and told me about it.
Grammer got a fellow high-ranking police officer to listen in on the phone. Then he typed up a report, and they gave it to Police Chief Jesse Curry.
The chief picked it up, and he looked at it maybe for 10 seconds. He said, "Oh, there's none of that," and laid it back down. We said, "Okay," so we walked out.
Grammer says the department was getting lots of calls threatening to kill Oswald. But Billy had a bad feeling about that call he got.
I remember when I got home on Sunday morning, I told my wife, "Somebody's going to kill Oswald in the basement of City Hall this morning." And she kind of laughed about it a little bit.
Later, she woke him up to the news.
I got up and went in, and the TV was on, and when I looked at it, the first person I saw was Jack Ruby. And I thought, oh, me. I knew this was going to happen.
Like so many aspects of this case, what you believe about this late-night phone call comes down to what inference you make about whether Grammer is telling the truth. But even if you think Grammer is being honest, and I do, this incident is just one more data point to try to get at Ruby's motive and whether he killed Oswald on his own or he was put up to it by someone else. Next time on Solving JFK, we'll focus our attention on Jack Ruby. What was Ruby up to the weekend of the assassination before he would eventually kill Oswald on Sunday morning? How did Ruby get himself into a position to make that shot? Is there reason to believe that Ruby's relationship with police officers allowed him to get access? And finally, we'll look at Ruby's motive. Why did Jack Ruby kill Lee Harvey Oswald? If you heard anything on this episode that lacks context or you think is incorrect, please let us know. You can email solvingjfkpodcast@gmail.com. Please provide a citation and we'll consider it for a future rebuttal episode.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
Thanks for listening. Visit solvingjfkpodcast.com for more information.
I'm getting